In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
We just finished celebrating Independence Day, but we're not free from tyranny. Not as long as there are big government types who want to, and believe it is their right to, control every facet of your life and business. All must be in line with the great gods of government. If some people are terrified of a disease, and that terror gives government extra means to control people, then all must be terrified of a disease. It doesn't matter if things like, science or math tell you that 99.8% of people survive. Don't trust that science. Trust what we tell you about science. And our science says you must be terrified. You cannot go to churches. You cannot go out to eat. Because if you did, it means our terrifying science isn't terrifying. Therefore, we will take away your right to make your own decisions about how you spend your life and what risks we're willing to let you make. As long as that kind of thinking persists, we are in a perpetual state of tyranny, because it will only take one flare-up, one variant, one minor outbreak, and all of your rights are thrown out again. The emergency powers vested in a single person must be stripped. But no government has ever given up its power willingly. It must be taken from them. Here in Oregon, from what I'm seeing, if you're an incumbent, it's time for you to go home. You are not so vital that you can't or shouldn't be replaced, and that includes Republicans. Do I want Democrats to retain power? Absolutely not. They are the problem, because Republicans have been powerless for two decades. We are in a state of tyranny. Keeping things the same will change nothing. But these Republicans need replaced with better ones, and more of them. In the second half of today's show, you'll hear how this crop of Republicans wouldn't stand by a fellow Republican House member the first time he ran into trouble. If they're willing to sell out a colleague, a friend whom they knew far better than you, some voter in their district, why wouldn't they sell you out? Or some vague principles they say guides their decision-making? Doubt me? Not one of them stood on principles when they took that vote. And the abuse by our government and political leaders is just going to happen again and again and again, unless and until their supreme power is taken from them. It won't change until you change who's there. I'd like to welcome Jason Brandt. He's the president and CEO of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, or ORLA. ORLA advocates for over 10,000 food service locations and more than 2,000 lodging establishments in Oregon, or that used to be the total anyway, thanks to Governor Brown. Jason, it's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
We'd like to get to know your organization just a little bit better. Your website says ORLA advocates for favorable laws and fair regulations and helps stop unfair taxes and anti-business legislation in their tracks, and we are definitely all for that. But you also provide training. Tell our audience about some of the training that ORLA offers its members.
Yeah, some of the more familiar ones are those for food handler cards, alcohol server courses. So if you're a bartender in Oregon, you have to have an alcohol server permit to serve alcohol in a food service establishment. And of course, if you're handling food, regardless of the food service establishment, you need a food handler's card. So those are kind of two primary trainings, and we also do serve safe food manager certifications. Most food service locations across the state will have at least one serve safe certified food manager, and that's someone that's staying on track and on top of all the cleanliness and sanitation standards for that restaurant location.
Hmm. So let's talk about the state of restaurants and lodging in Oregon, and just as sort of an overview, is the state of your industry in this state near the bottom, since our shutdown was the longest in the nation, or are Oregon's restaurants and lodging in about the same condition as other states?
I think they're in about the same condition, to be pretty candid about that. I mean, there's so much ebb and flow throughout the last 16 months, and the regulations that have been implemented here from government rules or just marketplace forces compared to other states, there's a lot of similarities, but then again, you know, there's a lot of differences amongst the business models out there. So, you know, when you think about the hospitality industry, you have to think about everything from, you know, a fast food drive-through location or a beverage location all the way up to, you know, a white tablecloth fine dining anniversary type restaurant location. And then for lodging establishments, it's everything from, you know, a local bed and breakfast or a private or public campground that you stay in and pitch a tent in, all the way up to some of the largest, most luxurious hotels we have in the state, whether that's, you know, the Benson Hotel in downtown Portland or the Nines or you know, places like the Allison Inn and Spa, for example, out in Newburgh. So just a great variety in the industry. And so because of that, you know, the regulations and the marketplace forces have impacted each one of those hospitality businesses in very unique ways. And so we have quite a mixed bag out there of where businesses are in our industry and what they're going to need to fully recover.
Speaking of recovery, in a June 25th Orla news release titled Oregon Hospitality Freed from Restrictions No Later Than June 30, you said we went through 15 months and 13 days of historic and overreaching government regulation, but you also have this very ominous subheading. There is no light switch. It will take years to build back what we lost. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, the primary driver for that comment in the press release has to do with our workforce access issues and also the displacement of workers that once received their paychecks in our industry. So if we rewind the tape and we go back to before that period, just over 15 months ago, what we would see is just over 180,000 Oregonians getting their paychecks from the variety I was just mentioning of hospitality businesses. So that huge swath of lodging offerings as well as restaurant offerings. So 180,000. Where we are today, we're at about 155,000. So we're still, you know, well short, 25,000 Oregonians short of being where we were before COVID started. And, you know, if it was normal times, then over the last 16 months, I think we would have seen increasing success and growth overall in the industry. So we lost that 16 months of growth, which is, you know, a bit of a setback. Plus, we have kind of an unknown challenge of how many workers we actually have that are displaced and have moved on to other industries and how we're going to find new workers or convince some of those workers to come back and be a part of the hospitality industry once again. And what we hear most often from operators is the unreliability of the schedule and the way in which the regulations continue to shift. It just created a human resource and operational nightmare for so many different types of businesses, not just our industry, but other industries as well. Fitness centers and gyms come to mind as an example. But it's just really hard for our folks out there to convince people to stick with the job when you are not going to have a reliable paycheck.
Yeah, exactly.
If we look back and think about all of those places when the rules changed and how many phone calls and emails had to be sent out to staff to change their schedules, I mean, it's hard to blame people for looking for work in other industries. So we got a lot of work to do on that front.
Sure, absolutely. You know, just the on-off light switch, essentially. You just couldn't depend on anything. So do you get the sense that the people in charge at the state thought there was a light switch, that they could just switch things off? And so, of course, businesses can just switch things back on so easily.
In a broader sense, I do think there was a feeling amongst many that serve in kind of economist roles that we were going to have a faster, more robust recovery than what we've seen in previous recessions. And candidly, a lot of that has come true. I mean, when you look at the numbers, it does appear that a number of industries are kind of roaring back and are even exceeding their trajectory for growth when those growth models were forecasted before the pandemic even hit, which is really incredible. I had a chance to be in Boston recently with some of my counterparts. And I was listening to some of these stats from an MIT professor in person, and it was really fascinating to hear about the broader economy and how fast American business has persevered and rebounded. Our storyline isn't quite that rosy for hospitality, and it's because we're a service industry. We're a public-facing business where we have face-to-face contact, communication, and interactions to bring happiness and joy to people's lives. That's what we do in our industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you have an airborne virus, I mean, it's a kind of the perfect storm to create, you know, ruptures and rifts and long lasting damage in an industry that has a model that's based on, you know, face-to-face interactions. So we are not that storyline, and we have a lot more work to do than your typical industry out there to rebound.
Oh, absolutely. All right, let's take a break there. Coming up, we'll look at the devastation Oregon's political leaders have wrought on the restaurant and lodging industry and how they get out of this. And welcome back. We're talking with Jason Brandt. He's the president and CEO of ORLA. That's the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. You can find out more about them by heading to OregonRLA.org. That's OregonRLA.org. And of course, we'll put that up on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com in case you didn't catch that or you're not where you can write that down. So why was Oregon's governor so punitive towards Oregon's restaurants and lodging in particular? I mean, why did she seem to zero in on them? Or is that a misperception and that she wasn't really harder on them than any other business?
I think a lot of it comes down to theories and attempts to try to manage in what I feel was an uncontrollable virus when it comes to spread. We can take certain protocols and precautions as citizens ourselves in our own daily choices in our daily lives and make sure we're being safe for our friends and our family. But there, I believe there was not just in our state, but across the country and across the world, certain scientific standards that we believed were going to help mitigate how fast the virus would spread and ultimately save lives by implementing those types of rules and regulations. And I think the jury will always be out on how helpful or impactful they actually were, how necessary they actually were. I'd like to believe that in a society like America with the freedom that we have, that we can trust people to make the right decisions and prevent spread of viruses that are going to be incredibly damaging to our communities. In this case, I think especially along the West Coast and a little bit on the East Coast as well, and kind of scattered throughout the country, we just had very strong opinions and rules that were forced into place based on health advisory committees that were set up through state infrastructures really across the country and in other countries around the world. And they're based on what we think is best to save lives. That's kind of where it was coming from. I do believe it was coming from a good place. It just had such enormous consequences on people's livelihoods. So, I would expect that debate to continue for years to come, lives versus livelihoods. And how do you balance that equation? How do you balance the scales? You know, do we really fully understand the impact on people's lives and even their own mortality when their jobs and their paychecks are stripped from them when it comes to how that affects them longer term? So we just have a lot of conversations, I think, to come as we unpack everything that has been experienced through COVID and the fact that we still have COVID in our communities across this country. So it's the journey is not over yet.
No, it certainly isn't. And I think, as you say, the debate about things is going to continue for years, if not decades. I think it comes down to personal choice is that, you know, if you realize that there's danger out there, then you need to act responsibly. You need to take care of yourself. And if we all took that personal responsibility seriously, then I think that helps everybody. But at the same time, people should be able to make those decisions and accept those risks. Getting back to restaurant owners and what seemed to be kind of an attack on them in some ways, I mean, is that what your members kind of felt? I mean, did you get the sense that they felt that they didn't matter to the state? I mean, that your industry just doesn't matter? I mean, how did your members react to Oregon's constant on and off again shutdowns? Did they seem to take it personally?
Yeah, many of them did take it personally, and I think they continue to do so. It's something that will live with them for their lifetimes, I would imagine. Something I'll never forget, of course, in my professional role in our work to represent them. But yeah, I mean, again, with an industry that's so public-facing, with an airborne virus that's spread across the world, we really were an easy target. Even though a virus that's as prolific as COVID that has such an easy way to transmit itself from one person to the next person, you know, people in positions of authority were looking for opportunities to showcase, you know, some semblance of managerial control, I believe, you know, over the onslaught of the virus's attack on their people, whether that's here in Oregon or in another state or in another country. So that was the challenge for anyone that's in a role as a governor, in particular in our state or in our country, is to decide what rules and regulations you're going to get put in place and making sure that those are meaningful and to the overall health and vibrancy of your state. And I think we got off track somewhere along the line. I certainly understand certain regulations and rules that have to be in place to help control virus spread. And we, of course, want to encourage people out there to get vaccinated if they haven't done so yet. And it's certainly going to help our industry rebound the further we go along that track. But if we look back at some of the ways that we went sideways, I think the rules became overwhelming and unnecessary when we crossed the boundary of not focusing in on our healthcare capacity and what we needed to make sure that we were saving lives if they did get into trouble with COVID. And the regulations kind of went beyond that. And remember when we started all of this 16 months ago, it was always to flatten the curve. That was the term. Let's flatten the curve for a 2-week period. Everyone's like, okay, we can do this for 2 weeks. And 16 months later, we're kind of looking at the collateral damage of the proliferation of the rules and regulations and just how they impacted every single person's life, not just here in this state, but really across the country and across the world.
Sure. Let's talk real quick about the labor issue here within Oregon, especially in terms of how it has hit restaurants and lodging. It seems to have hit those industries far more than it has other industries. Why are people so reluctant to go back to work?
I think we got a bit of a mixed bag again on this labor policy front with our state employment offices really across the country. Basically, just over half of the states at this point have decided to rescind the federal unemployment boost of $300 extra per week, which if it's not rescinded by a state, that goes all the way through Labor Day weekend. Oregon is one of about half of the states that have decided to keep the federal unemployment boost in place. And so if you're not actively in a job and showing up to work, but you're able to show some evidence of searching for work here in Oregon, then you can continue to collect unemployment with the federal boost. It equates to just under $17 per hour. So that's quite a bit of money to not have to actually show up, report to a supervisor or a boss, and kind of wait this thing out until that federal unemployment boost is gone. Now, there's a whole bunch of different, you know, debates out there. It's not just unemployment, so I want to make sure that's clear. But it's certainly a huge factor that we're hearing the most about at our state association. People
It's certainly the on and off again, where you just don't know if they're going to be shut down again. And you know, that uncertainty, that's what businesses really need, is they need to be able to handle that uncertainty. All right, let's take a break there. Coming up, how do we rebuild this and what challenges lie ahead? And welcome back. We've been talking today with Jason Brandt. He's the president and CEO of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association about the devastation that Oregon's political policies did to these industries. But now I'd like to focus on rebuilding and the road ahead. Jason, in that last segment there, we're talking about the labor issues, and Oregon lost a bunch of people. For the first time in a long time, Oregon was a net negative on population movement. We were the fifth most moved out of state in 2020, jumping up 16 places from the previous year. We lost more people than New York State did, if you can believe it. And I see help wanted signs everywhere. Do you think that there's an issue of not just within the industry, but are there just not enough people who would normally jump in to cover these jobs because they've moved elsewhere?
Yeah, I do think we have a bit of a housing supply issue, whether you're talking about, you know, multi-unit housing or single-family residential housing, not just in Oregon, but really across the West Coast. we are pricing working families out of the market to be able to afford that first home, even be able to afford apartment rent at this point. And that's a huge issue. I mean, especially in the service industry where we're really building people up for future careers, whether they want to manage a restaurant or own a restaurant in the future, or whether they want to run a hotel, or if they're gonna hop to a different industry and use all of those interpersonal skills they've developed in our industry and make good use of them in a different industry. So we really have been and continue to be America's training ground here in Oregon and across the country. So if we don't have the opportunity to provide these skill development training opportunities, then I'm kind of wondering what happens then. Where do people learn the soft skills and the ability to work with people and problem solve in face-to-face situations if we're not giving them that start with their career as, you know, when they're young adults? We do a lot of that in our industry. So yeah, we're concerned about how many people are still on the sidelines, whether they're in the sidelines and have moved to other states or whether they're still here in Oregon.
Hmm. So getting back to rebuilding restaurants and lodging and building back the issue of certainty within the industries, you guys had filed a lawsuit back in November of 2020. I know that has since gone away, but are you guys considering a second lawsuit? Because personally, I think these orders, these executive orders, the seizing of emergency powers, so long as it's declared a health emergency, it needs to stop, because otherwise it's just all going to happen again.
Yeah, we've looked at the lawsuit track a number of times, not just when we first went after the lawsuit in November, and it did not go anywhere. The judge found that, you know, our governor here, as well as governors really across the country, have the authority to institute emergency rules and regulations in the event of public health emergencies. So the power was really overarching. Now, I do think that we have opportunities to make sure there's more checks and balances as a part of our legislative system in the future. In my personal opinion, the Oregon legislature extended way too much authority to one individual in our state, as opposed to making sure they were at the table and were a part of that checks and balance process. So I think that the remedy and the solution here is healthy debate and respectful discourse in our legislature about what that process looks like to make sure that we reinstitute checks and balances so we learn the lessons from the past 16 months.
Hmm. So has this shutdown and attack on your industries, has it actually made them stronger in some ways and maybe more united? Are they helping each other out?
You know, I think maybe eventually we'll see more of that. The unity is kind of hard to come by right now when everyone's competing for those same workers.
Sure.
So there's really, similar to what people are experiencing when they're trying to buy a home, there's basically a price war going on for workers, which, you know, many would argue is not a bad thing. So wages are going up, particularly starting wages for people that haven't had much employment history. So that's, again, our opportunity to train people up. So those wages are going up, which does, you know, force prices up, whether you're staying overnight somewhere or whether you're going out to eat. So yeah, there's going to be unity, I think, in the future. But right now we got this battle for the best people when they're applying for jobs. So that's a big challenge. And then the lessons that have been learned on the restaurant side, there's quite a few lessons, actually. You know, we have people that have put together new drink programs for to-go cocktails. And so you make quite a bit of profit margin every time you sell an alcoholic drink. So folks are starting to do that a little bit more on menus. So when you go out to eat, you might be asked by a server, hey, you want to take a couple of our signature drinks to go and maybe enjoy them later tonight. So that's one thing. And then, of course, to-go orders and takeout and delivery processes and the software systems behind those products and those offerings, that's also taken a pretty major step forward. And then really across the industry for restaurants and lodging, there's just a lot more talk about automation. So what's the place of automation and, you know, even kind of robotic elements that are in place in restaurants and hotels in the future, whether that's for parts of the housekeeping needs that hotels and lodging establishments have, or whether that's for, you know, some more kind of robotics in the back of the house in the kitchen with equipment. So
sure.
I think we're going to see a lot of new things in the next 10 years or so.
Yeah, you guys had an interesting article that we'll put up on iSpyRadio.com on today's show page about the influence of data, and a surprising place is actually in the management side in terms of predictive software that can look at historical sales and whatnot. So that's another innovation that I found to be really interesting. So real quick, and we only got about a minute here with you, what happens if the governor decides to shut down things again?
Well, I really do not think that's going to happen. If there's one thing that I've been able to rely on, it when the governor says that we're not going to be shutting down businesses again for the duration of the pandemic, I take her at her word that she means it. And we have other states that have all moved on at this point. Our country is fully reopened. We've, you know, hit our 70% vaccination goal for 18 and older adults with at least one shot. So we're above average from, you know, a nation wide standard. Mm. So there really are positive signs that are not keeping me up at night worrying about a newfound order or a regulation that will take us backwards yet again. So I do believe with confidence that we are past this, and I don't thankfully need to worry about answering that question based on what we know about the direction of the state at this point in the crisis.
Well, I certainly hope that's true. I am not quite so trusting. I'm the type that fooled me once.
Sure.
Shame on you. Fool me for 16 months. Shame on me. So, anyway, Jason, I want to thank you so much.
You're not alone. Yeah, no. Thank you so much for sharing that, because I think everyone's kind of you know, on pins and needles still, because it's been quite a ride for 16 months, and certainly understand that position.
Yep. Jason, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
I am all for recalls. No elected officials should feel secure in their positions. They should instead feel the warm breath of the voters on the back of their necks at all times. It's the ones who feel secure in their positions who make the bad votes, the compromising votes, to reach across the aisle, because they're more interested in the approval of their colleagues than the approval of their voters. A sure sign of a secure representative is when they start boasting about working with the other side, especially in today's political environment when there are rare, if any, conservative Democrats. So if there aren't any conservative Democrats in the building, then who are you working with? The new Democrats are all socialists. That's who you're working with, and you're bragging about it? I'd like to welcome Representative Mike Nierman to the show. Sadly, he's now former Representative Nierman after the Democrats and Republicans in the House united to disenfranchise the voters of his district and for the first time in Oregon history expelled a sitting representative. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Good. Thanks for having me on, Mark.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I know you have an ongoing legal battle, and so I don't want to talk too much about the events at the Salem Capitol. But can you maybe sum up what happened and why you were expelled?
Yeah, so I think most of the things that happened are pretty well on video, and everybody's seen the video and everything. I opened up a Capitol door, and that allowed people to get in, citizens of the state of Oregon, and then some of them misbehaved in there or whatever, and so I'm being held accountable for that. So I think that the reason that people were there and were protesting outside is because they were upset because they couldn't get in their Capitol, and I think that some of the people who had the Capitol closed might want to be held accountable for that too. So anyway, so that was basically why they expelled me.
So what were the rules in place at the time governing the Capitol, and who was or was not allowed in? I mean, and who set those rules, and how is it this has now ended up becoming a criminal issue?
Yeah, so it's it wasn't Kate Brown who set those rules. It was the House political leadership. So it was Tina Kotek, the Speaker of the House, and Peter Courtney, the Senate President, that put forth the House rules. They are voted on by the bodies, and so the whole House and the whole Senate are responsible for that. So and the Capitol was the building was physically closed to the public. They claim that the proceedings were not closed because they were on
Zoom and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't Zoom brand, but same thing with, you know, televised meetings, whatever. So anyway, that's where it came from.
So we'll talk about the political side of things a bit more later, but what legal consequences are you now facing, and where do things stand legally?
So I have two charges against me. One of them is accessory to trespass, and I think that kind of speaks for itself. The other one is, and I forget how it's exactly worded, but it's kind of like abuse of office. So the idea is that I had access to the building, and other people weren't supposed to be in the building, and so I abused that special privilege that I had to have access to the building by letting other people in the building. Both of those are misdemeanors, and right now it's waiting to go to trial. It probably won't go to trial until fall, so it's quite a ways away.
But in terms of, okay, if these are just misdemeanors, what kinds of charges, I mean, what kind of fines and whatnot and or jail time are you faced with?
So actually, each one is up to a year in jail. So worst case scenario, it could be 2 years in prison for me. But I, if they've wanted me to serve them concurrently or something, I knock wood. But I just don't think that really. That's pretty extreme, so I don't really expect that outcome. But you just never know with the political left just wanting to get a drop of blood or whatever. And then I'm not sure what the maximum fines are, but it's in the thousands of dollars. So that's what I'm looking at there.
Hmm. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break a little bit earlier here because coming up we'll be talking some more about recalls and inside politics and some dangerous precedents that this sets. All that and more with former Representative Mike Nierman. We're talking today with former Representative Mike Nierman, who was expelled by unanimous vote, except his own, of course, from the House for his actions at Salem Capitol, allowing some protesters into the building at a time when the Democrats had wanted it closed to all Oregonians, except legislators. Democrats taking the democracy right out of things here. And Mike, as we said, you were expelled. I'm not surprised Democrats wanted you gone. But I am a little surprised, but not much, that your fellow Republicans first publicly shamed you with a letter they released to the public where they had urged you to step down and then voted unanimously with the Democrats to expel you. Did it surprise you that none of your friends and colleagues stood up for you?
Yeah, I did, and I kind of didn't believe it until it actually happened there that they were completely united against me like that. And I can't help but thinking that they're letting the media and the Democrats do their thinking and voting more out of fear than out of actual justice and doing the right thing. And especially some people that I was close to in the legislature. So I just find that really, really kind of disheartening. Not so much focused on me, but that I don't know, part of the inability to stand up to Democrats and the party in power. So it's just kind of disheartening that we have a whole group of 23 Republicans in the House, or 22, excluding me, 22 Republicans in the House that couldn't just stand up and say, no, Nierman needs to have his day in court. He needs to have due process. And no, Nierman needs to be judged by the people in his district, not by us. And I'm kind of sorry that that didn't happen.
Well, I am too. I've been rather disappointed with both the House and the Senate Republicans this year. They seem to have learned nothing from the last couple of sessions when they did walk out and forced some bad bills to basically be tabled, especially over the carbon tax credits and whatnot. And as we said, this is it's a misdemeanor crime. I certainly didn't see this worthy of expulsion, and especially it being a new situation. I mean, that it was the first time the Capitol had been closed, and so they had these new rules in place. To me, you're essentially a first-time offender. Expulsion? No way. It should never have gotten that far.
Yeah, and especially considering that no matter what you think about what I did, whatever, I think it's pretty clear that what I did, as a protest and as a act of civil disobedience, and not as a attempt to harm anybody or anything like that. And I think, it seems like every session there's some legislator that gets in trouble because he's trying to take liberties with the opposite sex or something like that. Or
yeah. And they stay there. Yeah.
Yeah, and they stay there. So I think especially the idea of expelling someone who, at least for Republicans, committed an act of civil disobedience in support of something that they were in support of, which was opening the Capitol. And again, I get it that not everybody thinks that what I did was a good thing, but that's kind of hard for me to understand that then that should result in expulsion. I think you're exactly right. That's over the
well,
top.
Well, what I don't like is the dangerous precedent that this sets, is because you went from essentially a first-time offender over brand new rules, and normally they would, you know, just give you a slap on the hand, to outright expulsion. So, and the Republicans fell right in line with this. And so is this the new precedent that if you have people that you don't like, you set some rules and you find means to expel them? I mean, this is a horrible abuse of power, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think so. So I think that the people that voted for this are going to have to live with that vote. And I understand some of them are already getting some pressure about it. So.
Well, and they should. And so after being expelled, the PCPs in your district voted to have you reinstated. This is, you know, part of the process to fill that vacancy. So the PCPs mm-hmm. Voted you. I mean, you got the most votes of any of candidates there by the PCPs. But the final mm-hmm. decision for replacements falls to county commissioners in your district, who then also ignored the will of the voters, ironically enough, and selected Anna Scharf instead, even though you had gotten the most votes. And that's really too bad. I would have liked to have seen commissioners stand up to these legislative bullies. I mean, were they afraid to do so? And what would have happened if they had selected you?
Yeah, it was funny. So what one of the commissioners, in explaining his vote to not vote for me, said that he regarded the decision of the precinct committee people as a slap in the face to the legislature. And I, you know,
yes, that's called democracy. You're exactly right.
Thinking, yeah, that maybe the legislature needs a slap in the face every now and then, so it's maybe not a bad thing. But I'm kind of disappointed in the county commissioners. I will say I'm very proud of Yamhill County Commissioner Mary Sterrett. She
yes.
did vote for me. And again, yes. not wanting to make this about me, but in her speech, she made it very clear that the will of the people needed to be respected. And so I'm very, very pleased that she had enough courage to stand up and say that. And then I also want to say that Anna Scharf is a super quality person, and she'll do a great job as the new representative for House District 23. So I'm very supportive of her.
Yeah, I don't know her personally, but I have heard good things about her. And hats off to Mary Sterrett for standing up for the voters as well. You mm-hmm. know, as we look at your situation where your fellow Republicans and the Democrat colleagues there all decided to thwart the will of the voters, as I said, I'm all for recalls, but it really should be the voters doing it, not the legislature. And I mean, so much for democracy when the people elect somebody, but those in power think that they have the right to overturn the will of the people. How do you even call yourself a Democrat at that point?
Yeah, although the framers of the Oregon Constitution did put this procedure in the Oregon Constitution, so it's part of the, you know, it's a legitimate procedure. You almost think for removal from office is something that should be based on, I don't know, something a little bit more awful than what I did, and so. And then, you know, maybe where there's a big crime committed or something like that. And I just don't think this rose to that. But anyway, that's my opinion. I'm outvoted 59-1 on that one.
So what would have happened if the commissioners had reinstated you?
So I would have to be sworn in again, and I would just have done that. I can't imagine that the speaker would have assigned me to any committees, so I would have not had any committees, but I still would have been able to vote on the floor and you know, participate in the movement of legislation.
Do you think they would have tried to expel you again?
Well, the Oregon Constitution says you can't be expelled twice for the same offense, and I think I'm a pretty clean living person, so I think it would have been hard to come up with anything that they could have passed the laugh test and expelled me again. So,
yeah. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there, because there's a bit more political arrogance out there that I want to talk to you about. This is SB 865, more maneuvering to thwart the will of the voters. Stay with us. More with Mike Nierman. And welcome back. This is the I Spy Radio Show. This is our last segment now. We're talking with former Representative Mike Nierman, who was expelled by unanimous vote from the House for his actions at Salem Capitol to allow some protesters into the building at a time when Democrats had closed it off to Oregonians. And Mike, in this last segment, there's, you know, it's bad enough when Democrats sabotage Republicans. It's even worse, I think, when Republicans end up sabotaging Republicans. And there's a bill that was introduced. It's rather shocking. It's SB 865, and this would prohibit people from simultaneously serving as a holder of a state office and as the officer of a state central committee of a political party. Had it passed, the current chair, Senator Hurd, and also Senator Linthicum, who serves as his treasurer, would have had to step down. What do you make of this bill?
Yeah, so like you said, you know, when you this is completely anti-democratic. It's anti-free yes. speech, you know, as far as like, you know, if you would expect that people who are state representatives and state senators would be involved politically. And it's not unprecedented that they are or that, you know, people that are close to them are. So I myself am the vice chair of the Polk County Republican Party, which that isn't covered by this bill because it talks about state central committee, but it's certainly not unusual for people who are elected officials to be involved in party politics, and I think it's healthy. And I think that the parties deserve the right to choose who they want to be their officers. If they want Dallas Hurd, they can have Dallas Hurd, or if they want someone else, whatever. But it's very anti-democratic. That's what I thought of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're essentially moving away from a representative government to you'll do what we tell you to do. I mean, where you're even trying to tell members of political parties who they can and can't elect as their leaders. I was really shocked to see that this was introduced at the request of Malheur, Baker, and Morrow County Republican Executive Committees. It comes across as though they didn't get the results that they wanted in the last election, so they're actually turning to the legislature to get the people that they want. I find that really surprising coming from supposed Republicans.
Yeah, it is. Like I said, anti-democratic. And then that that two Republican legislators would be part of the chief sponsors
yes.
on it.
Yes.
That they're involved in trying to settle a score within the Senate caucus or something like that through legislation. And talk about a bad precedent. That's really a super bad precedent. I don't think we want to run things that way.
No, I don't either. The two Republican sponsors of this was Senator Lynn Finley, who's with Senate District 30, and then also I forget the other one there.
Bill Hansel.
Bill Hansel, that's right. Yes,
yeah.
He's from Senate District 29. But I just find that shocking, especially as I understand it, the supposed conflict that this bill addressed. You know, the fact that they are sitting senators and would be holding offices within the ORP. I mean, that was discussed as part of the vote, and they had fully addressed it, and yet the two were elected by very large margins. So, again, it just comes across as though people within the ORP were poor losers, and they didn't get the result they wanted, and so now they're trying to use the force of law to get it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And if you think about it, the conflict is not so much with the state, because there's no problem with the state being a state senator or whatever, and where your support comes from or where your money comes from. The conflict would be with the Oregon Republican Party saying you could use your influence as an elected official to manipulate the Oregon Republican Party elections, internal elections there. That's possibly a conflict. And so if this is a problem, and I just don't think it is, but if it is a problem, it's something that should be addressed in the ORP bylaws and not in state legislation.
Yes.
So it's really very misguided, and I'm glad it didn't really see the light of day. Whatever.
Well,
Rob Wagner, the Democrat senator from Lake Oswego, also was one of the chief sponsors
yes.
on this. And so to see like a Democrat jumping in to some Republican internal food fight is really ugly.
Oh, absolutely. And then again, just think of the precedent this opens. If you're saying who can be in charge of the ORP, why not have the state oversee the various bylaws and whatnot of the parties? I mean, this is, again, terrible precedent.
Yeah, it sure is.
So I said previously that I was not really happy with Republicans this year in either the House or Senate, and I'm kind of at the point where I think they all need to go. Let's just start over with a clean slate. I'm just not seeing any backbones in there. And in particular, there was an issue earlier this year where there were allegations that essentially the Republicans were bought off with this cash from the stimulus bill. Each senator would get $4 million and each representative got $2 million. And gee whiz, they didn't walk out on any of these bills, especially like the gun bills and whatnot. So what are your thoughts? Did Republicans sell out? Or was that all just unfortunate timing and had the appearance of selling out for cash?
Well, this stuff's really hard to trace down and really hard to document because people go into speaker's office and cut a deal or whatever, and it doesn't necessarily become public. So first of all, on the $2 million for representatives, $4 million for senators, that was kind of a breakdown of kind of a spread that they did for the some of the COVID money there to just spread it around. And I don't think there was that much monkey business on that. Just as evidence of that, I had requested $2 million for the city of Amity to work on some water projects, and my request was fulfilled, even though they were on the way to expelling me. So I just don't think there was that much monkey business with that money. But that's not the only money that was out there. And so there was lots of other money sloshing around and lots of other people trying to get their hands in the pie. And I don't have any specifics, but it's not outside of the realm of the imagination that people were not wanting to walk out because they were not wanting to jeopardize that money, or people voted to expel me because they were not wanting to jeopardize that money. So I just don't have any specific evidence of that.
Well, Mike, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to think of your time, and I don't get the sense that you're done in politics yet.
No, not really. We'll see. Maybe not elected office, but I'll still be around trying to cause as much trouble as I can.
We recently drove to Wyoming for our son's wedding just prior to Oregon lifting, magically, all of the COVID restrictions. And it was really interesting being in other freer states. It was likewise interesting for people of those states to hear what Oregonians had been put through. Probably the best reaction was from a hotel manager who said, "Oh no, our governor follows the Constitution." Wouldn't that be nice? Thank you for joining us. The rebellion starts today. If elected Republicans want to be Democrats, it's time for them to warm the bench until they remember that they are, in fact, Republicans. And it's time we reminded them of that. You wouldn't keep hiring lazy, inferior workers, would you? Then stop putting these slackers back into office. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.